You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy Friday, Shabbat Shalom, Jumma Mubarak, whatever it may be, TGIF. And welcome to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It is Friday. It's time for Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us from Vermont today, his home state. His website, sanders.senate.gov. Check out his newsletter and his constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United. And Bernie, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. I've got a long list here. Oil, women's health, dental, transportation, post office, things I'd love to hear from you about. Oil, we're now...
It has been a busy week, so let's just tick off some of the issues.
Let me give you a quick stat, if I may. I just got this in email. We now have more active oil and gas wells in the United States than all the rest of the world combined.
Well, all I can tell you is I was filling up my gas tank this morning. I was driving into work. A woman in front of me filling up hers at $50.
Yep.
That's not right, and I think she speaks for millions and millions of people. People are outraged at the high price of gas and oil. In rural states like Vermont, people drive long distances to work. It is really hurting them. Just a few points. Number one, we know that in the last 10 years, the oil companies have made over $1 trillion in profit. ExxonMobil has racked up more profits than any other corporation in the history of the world. But it is not just, I mean, what we are caught in right now is a squeeze not only from the oil companies, from Wall Street as well. There is now a growing consensus, not just my opinion, but just a whole lot of people, including Goldman Sachs, who acknowledge that one of the reasons that oil prices are soaring is because of speculation on the oil futures market. You know, when many people think about oil prices, they think about supply and demand. If you have a whole lot of supply and little demand, prices go down. If it's the opposite, prices go up. The truth is that right now, according to the Energy Information Administration, the supply of oil and gasoline is higher today, Tom, than it was 3 years ago when the national average for a gallon of gas was just $1.90. There's more supply. Meanwhile, the demand for oil in the United States is at its lowest level since April of 1997. Supply is high, demand is low, and yet prices are soaring. Why is that? Well, I would say that one of the reasons has to do with the excessive speculation we're seeing on the oil futures market. Companies like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, Chase, these guys now control 80% of the oil futures market. Their presence there has nothing to do with using oil. They're not in the airlines business. They're not in the they're not fuel dealers. They're not truckers. They do not use the product. Their function in life is to drive prices up and make as much money as they possibly can. The really outrageous situation with regard to all of that is that a couple of years ago, when financial reform was passed, a provision was placed in there that mandated the Commodities Future Trading Commission, CFTC, led by a fellow named Gary Gensler, to come up with limits on speculation, limit the amount of oil that any one company could own. He was supposed to have this done in January of 2011. It is still not done, and we're going to do everything that we can to force the CFTC to come up with these limitations and in excess of speculation, which I think would drive oil prices down significantly.
Yeah. And in 2008, we don't know if they're doing it right now because the CFTC, as you point out, has not been empowered. But in 2008, we now know that the Koch Industries used something called Contango. They leased four giant supertankers just before the price of gasoline started spiking in the United States and filled them with petroleum products and just parked them off the coast of the U.S. to reduce the supply.
Well, the issue is the CF, what is upsetting to many of us, and we are working hard on this issue, is the CFTC is empowered. They have the power to do the right thing, and yet they're waiting and waiting and waiting. They want more and more and more information. They're not acting. So we're going to be meeting with them and see if we can get them off the dime on that one.
Great.
Now, there's another issue that I think of concern. It shouldn't be of concern just to women, but to every American. Yesterday, we defeated by a 51-48 vote, 48 vote, I think, an amendment by Senator Blunt of Missouri, which I think was just an outrageous amendment, which said that an employer does not have to cover medical procedures or provisions if it violates his quote-unquote moral conscience, which is a vague term that can mean anything at all. So if you have an employer who believes that women should not use birth control, he will not cover that. If you have an employer who, for whatever reasons, does not want to cover treatment for AIDS, that could not be covered. So a worker would be totally, in terms of the kinds of coverage that a worker gets, would be totally under the control of an employer as to what kind of coverage he or she received. Clearly meant as an attack on women's health rights, reproductive rights, but it went even further than that. An outrageous provision, to my mind, and that their side was able to get, I think it was 48 votes is pretty frightening, but it was defeated 51-48. We had, I think, Olympia Snow, who will be retiring from the Senate, one of the few moderates left in the Republican Party, was the only Republican who voted for it. We have discussed in recent weeks an issue I know of interest to many, many listeners, and that is the status of the post office. Another issue that my office is working really hard on, the post office had wanted to shut down some 3,700 rural post offices, half of the mail processing plants in this country and Saturday service, and it shrink the number of jobs at the Postal Service by over 200,000. I have been working hard with a whole lot of Democratic colleagues. I think there are some Republican colleagues who understand that slowing down mail delivery service and shutting down rural post offices and laying off huge numbers of people or shrinking the number of postal workers is just not what we need right now. We need a new business model for the post office. We need them to be aggressive in coming up with new ways to raise revenue and not simply laying off huge numbers of people and shutting down post offices. We had another interesting hearing this week. I am chairman of the subcommittee on primary care. And one of the issues, Tom, you know, when we talk about health care and the fact that 50 million Americans have no health insurance, what we sometimes forget about is that even more people have no dental insurance, dental care. And the issue of affordable dental care and access to affordable dental care in this country is a huge, huge issue. And we had a wonderful hearing with a couple of good dentists, some experts on the issue. Bottom line in this country is that if you are a lower-income American, working-class American, it is hard for you to access the dental care you need. A lot of people are in pain. We ask folks to write us, and I would ask again if anyone wants to talk about their situation with regard to dental care. We have information up. We'd love to hear from you. You could send that information to our website, sanders.senate.gov. We've got over 1,200 stories of people, and many of them are just heartbreaking stories, people living with pain, teeth rotting in their own mouth, their kids can't get to a dentist, cost of dental care off the wall. So this is an issue we have to address in a number of ways, but I did want listeners to know that the issue of affordable dental care is something that we are working on. We also had Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island and I had an interesting press conference the other day on global warming. And you know who our guests were, Tom?
Yeah.
Our guests were some of the major insurance companies in the world. Insurance companies.
Yeah, they're picking up the bill.
That's exactly right. So here you had insurance companies saying, hey, we are seeing a huge increase in the amount of extreme weather disturbances, and we are picking up the bill. And anyone who thinks that global warming is not real should see what we have to deal with. So it was quite an interesting meeting.
That's remarkable. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for his newsletter, the Bernie Buzz, over there. It's great. And a quick heads up for our listeners on WWRL in New York and surrounding areas, and on Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, on TV, and everything else. Heist the movie is opening today at New York's Quad Cinemas, 34th Street, 34th and 13th Street in Manhattan, featuring Bernie Sanders, Robert Kuttner, David K. Johnston, Naomi Prinz. Robert Kuttner is going to be with us in the next hour on this program, and narrated by yours truly. So check that out. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our National Town Hall meeting. Bernie, you're still here?
Right here.
Okay. Desmond in Brooklyn, New York. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
First of all, thank you, gentlemen, for all that you do. And Senator Sanders, this question is directed to you. I have experience of having worked in the reinsurance industry, and back in the late 80s and early 90s, several companies were forced out of business by the huge losses by hurricanes in Florida. Ever since then, all over the country, people have had flood insurance basically stop being sold, or the premiums were incredibly high. With all the evidence that the conservatives and Republicans use against Democratic initiatives, why haven't the Democrats use the actuarial evidence that the insurance companies are refusing to write policies as proof that global warming exists?
You can never stay on the air because it's funny that you ask that question. You know why? Because just yesterday in Washington, D.C., Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and I had a press conference with the reinsurance industry making exactly that point, So some of us are, in fact, moving in that direction. Here you have a conservative industry, the reinsurance industry, and they are saying that these extreme weather disturbances, the storms, the hurricanes, the tornadoes, are costing them a fortune. The result is higher premiums for consumers, or in some cases, no insurance at all. So, Desmond, you're exactly right, and that is what we are doing.
Janice in Brandon, Vermont, watching on Free Speech TV. Janice, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie.
Hi, Janice.
In 1988 or 89, Canada wanted to put a pipeline down through Vermont on the side of Route 7, and it was propane or natural gas. It was not going to benefit Vermont at all. How did we stop that?
You know, Janice, that is a good question, and I honestly, I know the issue that you're talking about, and I can't give you the answer to that right now. But I think if you are talking about the Keystone XL project, it is an issue that my office and many other offices are working on. I think if we are serious about reversing global warming, if we're serious about cutting back on greenhouse gas emissions, you don't want to go into the tar sands, which is the dirtiest oil in the world, and with significantly more greenhouse gas impact than any other oil.
Jim, listening on WDTW in Detroit, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, good afternoon. My question is in regards to the Commodities and Modernization Futures Act of 2000. If we repeal that act, then the questions of possession and speculation go away. Why hasn't that bill been introduced to repeal the CFMA of 2000?
Jim, I'm just not familiar with that. I'm sorry.
Okay, that was just FYI, that was the law that Phil Graham got pushed through that had the Enron loophole in it.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, but as I mentioned earlier, right now, if Jim is, and I'm not sure that he is, if he's talking about speculation in commodities, I think the tool that we're trying to focus on right now is to demand that the CFTC do, in fact, what the law requires them to do. In a sense, they're breaking the law. They're ignoring the law. They claim they need more information. We think they should act right now and start reducing the amount of oil controlled by a handful of very large speculators.
Ray in Sebastian, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Ernie. Bernie, I'm sorry. I'm calling you because I've sent contributions to you, even though I live down in Florida. As an independent, and I can tell you I have an extreme case of independence, in 1968, while working at Papakenny and Lois, I was given two accounts to work on at the same time. Jake Chabots, public senator from the state of New York, his third reelection. And guess what? Bobby Kennedy decided to run. So the left side of my desk was Jake's campaign, and the right side of my desk was Bobby's campaign. I had no problem with that. The thing that I'm trying to bring up here is that there are many, many investigations that are covering these issues time and time again. I remember Scoop Jackson taking the oil boys, lining them up, and, you know, and really reaming them. and yet nobody wants to pull that stuff back up. As far as torture and the rest of these arguments about how to handle prisons and when is torture not torture, Fred Friendly...
Ray, pardon my interrupting you, but we have less than a minute.
Quick. You know, I would just say in terms of the oil issue, clearly, you know, the fact that Congress has not been more aggressive, that the White House has not been more aggressive, the White House is now talking, I think, quite sensibly about doing away with the various types of tax loopholes and subsidies that the oil industry is getting. The idea that you have this industry, which is enormously profitable, continuing to enjoy tax loopholes or get subsidies is absurd, and the president is right. But on the other hand, we have got to be very, very aggressive. With these oil prices, this impacts the entire economy, and it's going to bring more and more money to Wall Street, more and more money to the oil companies, while the, you know, average person is just paying that bill, and that's wrong, and Congress has got to be much more aggressive. Difficulty, you know, as always is the case, these guys have a whole lot of power in Congress.
Do you see anything coming out of the House or Senate that might ameliorate this?
Yeah. I think there's going to be, again, the focus that my office is working on, along with a number of other offices, is on the CFTC. We want them to obey the law. We want them to end excessive speculation on the oil futures market. We think if we do that, it will have a significant impact on dropping oil prices.
Good, good. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with a guy that I think of as America's senator, although the good citizens of Vermont know that they're his, and proudly so. Having been one myself for a decade, I can tell you. We'll be back with your questions and Bernie's answers right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. You can sign on to his constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United right there. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you on Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. You're there, Bernie?
Right here.
Okay, let's see where we go here. Ty, listening on AM 1260 in Santa Fe, New Mexico, KTRC. Hey, Ty, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Tom and Senator Sanders. I just would like to ask the senator if there is a correlation between the speculators in the war, and the rumors of war in Iran. It seems that there is. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, I think here's the point. What the speculators do is that any time there is an international crisis or the possibility of an international crisis, they use that as an excuse to say, hey, we don't know what's going to happen to the future of oil. And therefore, we have got to raise prices right now. They do that all of the time. So in this case, I think, Ty, you're right. They are using Iran or Syria or anything else as the reason as to why they are raising prices.
Jay in St. Petersburg, Florida, listening on WMNF. You are on the air, Senator Bernie Sanders.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, Senator.
Thank you.
I have a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization called We Can Take It, Incorporated, and we have a website at wecantakeit.org for your viewing or your listeners and viewers. This is we're trying to reestablish and reactivate the old United States Civilian Conservation Corps, and we have a bill in Congress that is on the House side by Marcy Kaptur of Ohio, H.R. 494, the 21st Century Civilian Conservation Corps Act. And also, we see a bill that is in the Senate for reactivating the WPA, which is another program from that era to bring jobs and to help with our infrastructure. Bernie, is there any movement in the Senate for would you be able to create the reflector bill in the Senate for H.R. 494?
Well,
and,
you know,
I thank you for
we could, and we are working on looking at a jobs bill. The issue is we can bring forth any kind of bill we want tomorrow, but the question is where it goes and how it fits in with the 50 other bills that we're working on. So what I would say to you, Jay, I applaud what you're doing, because I think that what we have to be cognizant of is that while unemployment is going down slightly, official unemployment is at 8.2%, lower than it used to be, real unemployment, including those who have given up looking for work and those who work in part-time when they want to work full-time, is much, much higher than that, maybe 15%. So Jay is absolutely right in saying that we have to put millions and millions and millions of people back to work. I happen to believe, and it, call it what you may, would be part of a Civilian Conservation Corps or WPA, rebuilding our infrastructure is one of the ways we have to go. Right now, as we speak, there's a transportation bill on the floor of the Senate. It is much too modest, much too small, but it begins the process of rebuilding roads, bridges, and rail, would create a very significant number of jobs. But if Jay is talking about going further than that, he's absolutely correct. We have to. It's something we will look at, Jay. We're just looking at a different bunch of different approaches as to how we can create the millions of jobs that we need. But certainly rebuilding infrastructure, transforming our energy system, changing, fundamentally changing our trade policy so the companies invest in America and not in China. Those are some of the things that we've got to do.
Linda in Barry, Vermont, a WDEV listener. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I'll try to be brief. I have a quick question. Why are United States savings bonds no longer available through payroll savings plans or from banks? Why is a little old grandmother no longer able to walk into a bank and buy a paper savings bond? They apparently no longer available unless you have internet access. And although most people do have internet access, not everyone does. So United States savings bonds are no longer available to everyone.
Well, Linda, thank you very much for making that point. And that is something that we will, in fact, look into. I think you make a good point.
Bernie, that might be something you could have post offices do even.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, when we talk about post offices and expanding the kinds of services the post offices can offer so they can bring in more revenue, certainly that is one of the areas that we could explore.
Joan in Ludington, Michigan. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, I've been retired on disability for a number of years now, and I'm acutely aware of a problem that most people don't even know exists, and that is that the COLA, that is the cost of living allowance, doesn't take into consideration volatiles like gasoline and food and other things that are dependent on transportation, heating and things like that. We appreciate getting that 3.6% raise, but it doesn't begin to make up for all the years it hasn't covered our cost of living. Not really.
Okay, John, thank you very much for that question. As I think most listeners know, certainly those who are seniors know, for the last 2 years there has been no COLA at all. As John indicated, there will be a COLA this year. John, I don't think you're quite right in your characterization of what a COLA takes into consideration. It takes into consideration the entire marketplace, whatever market basket, whatever people do consume, which is certainly heating oil and food and everything else. The problem with the current COLA as it applies to Social Security beneficiaries is that it when we look at how the COLA is formulated, it takes into consideration everything, all consumer products. Problem is that seniors are not out there buying laptop computers or iPhones. What seniors are spending their money on are prescription drugs, health care, staying warm in the wintertime. So I think the current configuration of how we determine what a COLA is, how the Department of Labor figures out what a COLA is, underestimates what seniors are actually spending. And that's an issue that we're trying to work on by developing a segregated, separate index for seniors who are spending money in areas such as healthcare, which are going up faster than general inflation.
Okay. Reese in Claremont, California, listening on KTLK on K-Talk. You're on the air, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Hello, Senator Sanders. I recently went on unemployment and due to some job losses, and I was shocked to find out that my unemployment is paid through the Bank of America, one of the banksters, the biggest banksters in the nation, that my unemployment is paid out through a Visa credit card. Apparently, the money's put into the bank's hands, and they dole it out to me, or they, you know, release it to me as I use it on my card, but I'm sure they're making interest on all of those, that money that I don't withdraw from them. How is it that we are doing that, and why doesn't the federal government issue its own credit card for unemployment?
Well,
I'll take my answer off here. Thanks for listening.
Okay, thanks, Reese. That's a very interesting point, something that we will take a look into.
Okay. Tracy in Milford, New Hampshire. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call. The thing I know, Bernie, that you're not a Democrat, but you do caucus with them, and I was wondering if perhaps you could mention that this whole health care, the health bill issue with contraception, the Republicans now made this more than a woman's issue. This is everybody's issue with that bill that narrowly got defeated yesterday because it would deny anybody care for anything that somebody had a moral objection to.
Tracy, you're absolutely right. It is not, it's obviously focused on women's reproductive rights, but you're quite right. To give an employer the right to determine what the benefit package is, to say, well, gee, I don't like, I'm not going to cover any AIDS treatment, or I have certain religious beliefs and I don't think you should get blood transplants, blood transfusions or a transplant. It is absolutely off the wall. And you're right. So it's not just the women's issue. It covers men as well. And I'm glad that we were able to defeat it. You know, Tom, I noticed that if I can switch gear for a moment,
mm-hmm.
I did want to mention today a number of callers have been raising issues, and we're going to try to look into some of them. But I did want to, what just occurred to me is a month or two ago, we had a caller who said, you know, she was a veteran, and she had walked into a veteran's hospital into the gift shop, and she was really surprised that most of the products that she was buying in that veteran VA gift shop was made in China and other countries. I don't know if you recall that question.
I do.
But I want to tell you that we have looked into that issue. We have talked to Secretary of the VA, General Shinseki, and that is an issue that they are now going to start working on. So here would be an example of a telephone call being turned into policy where the VA is going to make a stronger effort to buy American products, American-made products, in the gift shops and VA hospitals.
That is spectacular. A phone call on the Brunch with Bernie Hour turns into a change in policy at the Veterans Administration. I'm really impressed. That's great. Bernie, thank you so much. And we will be right back with more Senator Bernie Sanders answering your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if you haven't gotten over to Bernie's website right now, it's a great news resource, as well as his newsletter, and you can sign up for the Constitutional Amendment to Rollback Citizens United, Sanders.Senate.gov.
Give me your help not to win votes alone, but to win in this crusade to restore America to its own people.
Many little people in many little places do many little things, then the whole world changes, you see. We are looking for the same thing.
Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program, our Brunch with Bernie Hour, Senator Bernie Sanders answering your questions in our national town hall meeting, KIPP in Carbon, Indiana. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi.
Hello?
I'd like to know if you could just create a bill, like a poison pill extraction bill, to take the piece of legislation out of Medicare that won't allow them to negotiate drug prices, or take the piece of the post office bill that just causes them to have to pay 75 years in advance for their health care, and just focus on those particular poison pills that's been put in legislation that keeps the system from working.
Kip, thank you very much. And those are two issues that we're working on. We have been working very hard on the Postal Service. And I think the point that Kip makes, I want everybody to understand, but when you read in the paper that the Postal Service has financial problems, one of the major reasons why is that they have been asked, as Kip just said, to make 75 years of payment for future employee health care retirement benefits in a 10-year period, $5.5 billion a year. No other entity, federal, state, local, private sector, has come anywhere near close to having to make those types of payments. In fact, there is enough money in that health account to pay out benefits for 90 years. Within 21 years, there'll be enough money in that account. So we don't need to put more money in that account. And that is certainly one of the points that we have been making, Kip, as we try to save the post office, keep mail delivery service done in a timely manner, and protect rural post offices. The other issue that Kip raises is Medicare Part D. When the Republicans passed that bill, and I voted against it precisely for this reason, they put language in there that prevents Medicare from negotiating prescription drug prices with the pharmaceutical industry. So they have the absurdity within the federal government of the Veterans Administration getting lower prices for the same drug that Medicare is, because the VA, the Department of Defense, is negotiating, and yet Medicare is not. So Kip is absolutely right. We can save billions and billions of dollars in Medicare by having the government negotiate prices with the drug companies.
Jim in Torrance, California, listening on K-Talk. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Jim? Oh, Jim just vanished. Okay, then let's pick up another Los Angeles call. Marietta, listening on K-Talk in L.A. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Tom and Senator Sanders. It's wonderful to hear you guys daily. And my question's about Social Security. A limited population pays Social Security and Medicare, and we know it's a regressive tax. We know the government's borrowed all the money, and that I think we're like the number two creditor for the United States now, right behind China for Social Security or something ridiculous. But my question is, it's not really just used for the purpose intended, which was to be for retirement. Instead, my understanding is, let's say you come here from a foreign country, and you're old enough, you can actually get Social Security and Medicare. And then if somebody dies, I can understand their children getting Social Security till they're 18 or out of college or whatever the rule is. But you can also get Social Security when you retire for your children until they're 18, even though you're alive and collecting. So yeah, that is true, because I know people that are doing it. At 62, a man can retire with as many children, obviously, as he wants. Women, a little less likely. But, yes, they do. You can look into that one. That one's easy. But, anyway, it's such a draw on Social Security. And I'm just kind of curious, are there other funding mechanisms that take care of the Social Security and the Medicare that's going to people that never paid in? Or is that all coming out of this limited pocket of people that have to pay into Social Security and Medicare?
Well, I'm not quite sure that I agree with some of the facts that you brought forth, but what I do know, and I want to make this as clear as I can, because there's a lot of media distortion about this, Social Security today has a $2.5 trillion surplus. Okay? And everybody who studies the issue recognizes that and acknowledges that. Social Security has enough money in its trust fund to pay out benefits for 25 years. And importantly, to those people who want to cut Social Security or privatize it, because of the deficit and national debt problem, Social Security hasn't contributed to the deficit because it's funded by the payroll tax. So in my view, you know, there are rules about who is eligible for Social Security. People can take it at 62. You can take it at 65. You get less when you take it at 62. But the people who get Social Security benefit are people who have contributed into it.
Okay. Oops. Hang on just a second here. Tyler in Longview, Washington. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. We have just 1 minute left.
Hello.
So, real quick question.
Mine is about EBT cards and food stamps nowadays. I'm totally in favor of them, and I think we should actually be lowering the minimum to get on them. But I feel like lobbyists have taken over because you can buy anything with them. You can get soda. You can get chips. I feel like it should be like whole grain.
Okay. All right. I think it's right-wing caller day, Bernie.
Well, I don't know. That's right-wing caller. There is a discussion about that. You know, there are things that you can buy with food stamps. There are things that you can't buy. But in general, the reason that food stamp utilization has gone up in this country has to do with the fact that we are in the midst of a horrendous recession. A whole lot of people lost their jobs. People are on food stamps who never believed that they would be on food stamps. And I think we have to make sure that in this country, this great country, nobody in America goes hungry. And I know there are some Republicans who refer to the president as, quote-unquote, the food stamp president. All that they are talking about is that as a result of this Wall Street recession, we've got a lot more poor people now than we used to have. And in my view, in this country, people should not be going hungry.
Thank you so much, Bernie, for Senator Sanders, for being with us today and every Friday on Brunch with Bernie. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We'll be back with Robert Kuttner.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. There was a great movie review in the New York Times yesterday. Maybe it's in today's paper. I don't know. It was online last night. Tracing the Great Recession to a Memo 40 Years Ago by Stephen Holden. And what it's about is a movie called Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? The movie is opening today in Manhattan. Down in Greenwich Village at the Quad Cinema, 34 West 13th Street in New York City, features Bernie Sanders, who just spent an hour with us, David K. Johnston, Nomi Prinz, Van Jones. It's narrated by me, and Robert Kuttner is in the movie as well. And I'm so pleased to have him with us. The website for the movie, by the way, heist-themovie.com. And Bob, welcome to the program.
A pleasure as always, Tom.
Great to have you back with us. If we could put this in the context of the movie, you know, on screen, you said some pretty important things. Let me just kind of throw this open to you. You know, what's your sense of what this movie Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? Who did steal the American Dream? That's a good question.
Wall Street stole the American Dream, and it stole the American Dream in two ways. First, by its direct activities, such as the subprime meltdown and all of the stuff that we know too well that's explained nicely in the movie, but secondly, by capturing politics. Mm-hmm. So that when George W. Bush was defeated by Barack Obama at exactly the moment, September and October of 2008, when the whole thing came crashing down, instead of doing what Roosevelt did in 1933 and giving us a clean break and really going after the people who caused the collapse, Obama went and appointed the same people who brought us deregulation under Bill Clinton, Tim Geithner, Larry Summers, and company, and then he reappointed Ben Bernanke. And this was as if Franklin Roosevelt had responded to the repudiation of Hoover by appointing Hoover's economic team.
Now, is it reasonable, though, to say in Obama's defense that Hoover came in after 3 years Roosevelt came in after 3 years and Hoover had actually tried a few things. I mean, Hoover started the first, I'm forgetting the name of the agency, but the one of the first large agencies that was an attempt.
The RFC, Reconstruction.
Reconstruction.
That's right.
Yeah. And so there had been, after 3 years, I mean, when in fact, FDR campaigned on a platform of balancing the budget and making small steps. That's not what he did when he came into office, but
that's right.
I don't think Obama realized how bad things were, frankly, and that's what the people around him, the economists around him, are saying right now.
Well, I don't mean to pin it on Obama, and God knows we need to reelect Obama, but the point is that the Wall Street financiers had invaded both parties to such an extent that when Obama was elected president, the advice he got was, hey, you better appoint the A-team. And the A-team was made up of all the people who brought us deregulation.
Yeah.
So it would have taken an amazing act of prescience and courage for Obama to say, no, man, I'm going to appoint the B team. Even though the B team doesn't have the experience, I'm going to appoint Paul Krugman, I'm going to appoint Joe Stiglitz, people who really want to have a rupture with the forces that caused this collapse. And he was advised that, boy, if you do that, you're going to erode confidence even more, and that would be very risky. And so, you know, he followed the advice he was getting. My point is just that the advice he was getting was contoured by the incredible political power that Wall Street has had over both parties.
And how did they get that power?
Well, the usual way. I mean, as the economy has become an economy of more concentrated wealth, with concentrated wealth comes concentrated political power. And what John Kenneth Galbraith called countervailing institutions, like trade unions, have been steadily weakened over the past 30 or 40 years. And economists with dissenting views have been mostly driven out of the academy, you know, with a handful of exceptions. And this is what you would call hegemony. It's the complete dominance of a particular viewpoint that says deregulate, privatize, get the government off our backs, and the free market will, you know, behave with its usual efficient genius. And that whole theory, that whole practice came totally crashing down in 08. But we've had a very incomplete revolution. It has been discredited in fact, but we haven't completely reversed it in policy.
Yeah, and this is why I've been saying, you know, unless these things change, it's going to get worse again, because the structural, the really core structural stuff hasn't even largely been fixed. Your most recent book, Obama's Challenge, I know addresses this. The movie talks about the Powell memo, tracks a lot of the stuff back to Lewis Powell in 1971.
Yes.
And you know, in 1971, and in fact from the 30s, when Milton Friedman first started this kind of crank stuff, and the Austrian school was trying to get some, you know, and Frederick von Mises and all this stuff, these guys were trying to get some traction for the idea that the marketplace makes a trillion decisions a second, and therefore it's always going to be smarter than a politician with a five-year plan. That was largely ridiculed, that right-wing libertarian, Republican, but largely libertarian point of view, was largely ridiculed in the 30s, the 40s. Well, we saw it fail in the 20s, and so it was ridiculed in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. And even when Reagan was elected, people were very, very skeptical about it. And yet it has wormed its way into not just our body politic, but our body media, to the point that many pieces of this are accepted as conventional wisdom, Bob.
Yeah, and what's all the more remarkable is that even when it totally fell on its face in 07 and 08, a lot of people still believe that markets are efficient. And, you know, you mentioned the Powell memo in the movie Heist. So Powell writes that we, the right wing, need our own intellectuals, we need our own think tanks, we need our own coherent ideology, we need to invest big time in politicians. And they did it. They had a plan, they carried it out, they mobilized people like the Koch brothers. And so now you have all these think tanks spewing out this stuff. You got Fox News, and they have a very disciplined party line, and they've had a lot of impact.
So how do we push back on? We're talking with Robert Kuttner. He is one of the stars of the new documentary. It's out, opening today for a week in Manhattan, in New York City, at the
Longer than a week.
Say that again.
We hope longer than a week. If
yeah, we absolutely hope so. And in fact, are you going to show up for one of the nights?
Well, I had hoped to show up Sunday night. I've got a family commitment. I can't show up Sunday night, but I'm going to try and make it a night later in the week.
Okay, because I know several of the people who are in the movie are actually showing up, and you can get all that information over at the website, heist-themovie.com. And, you know, but you're one of the featured experts in the movie. So what? How do we get out of this, aside from, you know, hoping that the president himself can do something? There's a much larger picture here, and that is of citizen activism. I think, you know, had there not been the Bonus Army at the first occupation back in 1931, 32, Franklin Roosevelt wouldn't have had that wind behind his back to do a lot of what he did in 33. How do we do this?
Well, the Occupy movement suggests how we do it. We do it by organizing, And what's interesting about the Occupy movement, among many things that are interesting about it, is that even though, you know, a lot of middle America doesn't relate personally to what that scene looks like, middle America relates to the story that the 1% has too much and the 99% don't have enough. And, you know, the Occupy movement had a majority of support in the polls within a couple of weeks, and that says that there's a tremendous latent hunger for truth-telling, there's a tremendous latent hunger for organizing, and I hope that if we can get more citizen activism and we can get Obama reelected and really have, as you say, the wind to his back, we'll see a much more robust second term in the sense of really pushing back against Wall Street.
From your lips to God's ears. Robert Kuttner, you can check heist-themovie.com. And, of course, check out Bob Kuttner's book, his most recent book, Obama's Challenge. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's Anything Goes Friday. We'll be back. I've got a couple of stories here I want to share with you, and then we'll be picking up your calls on whatever topic you'd like to bring up today. 15 minutes past the hour.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Good office. Anything Goes Michigan, welcome back. Anything Goes Friday, welcome back. In Michigan, Mark, in Southfield, Michigan, listening to WDTW. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind?
Well, I'll tell you what, Tom, I'm really glad to hear from you there.
Yeah, I'm here.
The thing is this. One of the classic things that people are whining about on the right wing is about how the banking regulations required that the banks make unprofitable loans. Yet I'd like to know what's changed now. I changed my topic a little bit because I talked to you before about pensions. This is another thing that sticks to my craw. And how did the banks being forced to make subprime loans, which they weren't forced to make, cause the problem in Iceland, where Iceland's real estate crashed? None of it makes any sense. And the biggest thing is that the actual problem was, and I assume it's in the movie that the previous guest had put out, the real problem was the CDOs, the collateral debt obligations. I read one report one time that said the default one home was multiplied by a factor of 28 times, and I wish I knew what that link was. Maybe you could find it.
Yeah, I can tell you where you can find that information. Go to webofdebt.com and read Ellen Brown's analysis of this. We went from when the Commodity Futures Modernization Act was pushed through Congress by Phil Graham at the behest of his wife, Wendy, who was on the board of Enron. This was Ken Lay's little toy thing. But it also, not only did it allow Ken Lay to speculate in energy futures in a way that he hadn't been able to before, and to create an Enron bank to speculate in futures, but it also allowed the banksters on Wall Street to get into the futures business, and it created a gray market for these speculative instruments that had derived their value from underlying things like mortgages. And so not just, you know, IAG's, insurance on a mortgage, but now you could create a insurance on the insurance, in other words, a bet on the insurance, and then you could create an insurance on the insurance, a bet on that. And you could do that, 10, 20, 30 times out. And so, $100,000 mortgage becomes, $1 billion worth of equities. And we went from zero in 1999, zero of these so-called derivatives, to almost $900 trillion worth of them. Keep in mind, the GDP of the entire planet is $65 trillion. The GDP of the United States is $15 trillion. It was $900 trillion worth of these phony baloney bets on bets on bets. And you're absolutely right. No bank in America was ever forced to make a loan. That is a right-wing lie. And they keep promulgating it. And all you have to do is say to them, please name one bank and identify one person who went to a bank, and that bank was forced to give them a loan. Because if there was such a thing, Rush Limbaugh would be talking about it every day. He'd be talking about, back in 2003, when Bank of America was forced, they were threatened with going to jail if they didn't give, Jose Garcia or John Johnson or whatever a loan. There is no such thing. There isn't one. What they're doing is they're taking this law that was passed during the Carter administration that made it illegal for banks to redline, What banks used to do is they used to say, you know, this particular zip code or this particular neighborhood has a higher proportion of poor people in it, and so we're just not going to write mortgages for that area. So what would happen is neighborhoods were going through changes, or just, you know, they're neighborhoods, and mostly they were minority neighborhoods, but there are some people there, you know, there's a black middle class as well as poor black people, just the same with white people. And so if somebody was middle class and they had a decent job and they wanted to live in that neighborhood, they couldn't get a mortgage because the neighborhood had been redlined. So the Carter administration said, you have to make mortgage decisions based on the individual applying, not on the neighborhood in which the house is located. And so, and that's it. That's the beginning and end of it. It didn't force any banks to do anything except stop redlining, which was a horrible and racist practice. And so, Mark, you nailed it. And it was the speculation that just blew this thing up. And let me just tell you about speculation right now. In 2008, this is a piece that Lee Fung wrote for at the L.A. Progressive, laprogressive.com/Koch-Industries. You can find it. And the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, the chairman, Bart Clinton, at that time, has explained rampant oil speculation, which was at its highest level on record, is to blame for current prices. Now, this was a couple of years back. And he said, in 2008, Koch called attention to itself for contango. It's a word you may not be familiar with. I was not familiar with it until I read this piece. Contango, C-O-N-T-A-I-N, like container ships, go like off our coast. Contango oil market manipulation. A commodity market is said to be in contango when future prices are expected to rise. In other words, demand is expected to outstrip supply. And so big banks and companies like Coke employ a contango strategy by buying up oil and storing it in massive containers, both on land and offshore, to lock in the oil for sale later at a set price. In December of 2008, Coke leased 4 supertankers to hold oil in the U.S. Gulf Coast to take advantage of rising prices in the winter ahead. Fortune magazine, writing about this, Fortune magazine writer, about the Coke contango efforts, Coke brothers. Fortune magazine writer John Berger noted that they could be raising gasoline prices by anywhere from 20 to 40 cents a gallon at that time. And in fact, Coke executive David Chang boasted that falling crude prices in 2008 provided an opportunity to remove oil from the market for future delivery. And he did a whole presentation it was a slideshow done by Coke Supply and Trading. And slide number 36 read, "The return of speculators to oil, the macro trade is alive and well." Lee Fung writes, "The slideshow given to an industry association for oil speculators describes Coke as the world's top 5 crude oil traders and actively trades about 50 types of crude oil around the world. Notably, they have operations. Coke has trading operations in London, Geneva, Singapore, Houston, New York, Wichita, Rotterdam, and Mumbai." Surprise, surprise. Price of oil is going up. Price of gas is going up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
At the exact same time that the Koch brothers are working to bring the Democrats down. Surprised?
Thank God it's...
Yes, welcome back. Anything Goes Friday, and Marilyn in Fabren. I'm sure you can pronounce it very well. In France, Marilyn, what's the city?
Hi, Tom. It's Fabrizon.
Fabrizon. Okay.
Fabrizon, France.
Fabrizon,
yeah.
France. Okay.
It's a
little town. And what's up, Marilyn?
Well, you got some information about toll roads from somebody who said she used to live here, but things may have changed since she was here. So I'm going to try and correct the record.
Okay.
There are toll roads here. They're called auto routes. And if you look at a road map, any route labeled A and a number is an auto route. And they're like turnpikes or freeways. But they're not all privately owned. They were built by the government, and some of them have been, I don't know whether they're leased or sold or what, to private companies, but not all of them. One new one near me, which is not very heavily traveled, is still free. But the Viaduct of Millau, has a 6 euro charge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're really expensive to travel on. The ones that are that are privately maintained. They're well maintained, and they're nice to drive on, but it costs about a little over 10 euros to go for an hour and 15 minutes.
Wow, which would be like, what, $12, $13, something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
In the neighborhood.
So that's just from where I live to Toulouse, for example. It costs $10.10 each way.
Wow.
And so that's pretty high. So I've done some comparisons on, like, if I'm going to take a long trip, say a five-hour trip, is it cheaper to take the train or is it cheaper to drive? And if you're one person alone, it costs about the same to take the train second class, which is fine. There's no, I don't have a problem with second class. But it costs about the same to take the train as to drive the autoroute, including the gas and everything. But if you are two people, it is cheaper to drive because the train ticket, you know, two people, twice the ticket price. So it is still cheaper to drive if there's more than one person not in the car.
Okay.
And the auto routes are heavily used by trucks because they don't ship very much freight by rail here in Europe. It's mostly for passengers.
Mm-hmm.
So the auto routes are full of trucks, which sometimes is very unpleasant, but not always.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
That makes sense.
Go
ahead. I said that makes sense. Go. You wanted to finish your thought. I'm sorry.
Oh yeah. No, that's it. There. Oh, the small towns don't all have train stations here. In fact, hardly any of them do. So if you don't have a car at all and have to take a taxi to the nearest train station, that can add quite a bit to the cost of a trip as well.
Sure, sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Marilyn, thank you.
And in Amsterdam, they have x-ray machines at the airport.
Now, I thought they got rid of them. I thought the whole EU said
no. They have them. I've been traveling back and forth through Amsterdam to Seattle.
In the last few weeks?
The last trip was in January.
Yeah, because it was about a month or so ago that the EU announced no more X-ray machines.
Oh, really? Next time they won't. That would be nice.
Yeah.
But I don't go through them. They've been really nice about not making you do it.
Right. Well, and here in the U.S., they're getting, I mean, they used to have an attitude when you said, you know, I don't want to go through the X-ray machine. I'd rather be patted down. And now they're actually fairly nice about it, the few airports I've been through recently. So. It's interesting. Marilyn, thank you very much for calling, and thanks for watching us on the web. I'm assuming, right? On live stream?
No, I'm just listening on the telephone right now.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Marilyn. Great to have you call in. Thank you for the information. Dave, listening in Los Angeles on K-Talk. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You were talking about the mortgages and the credit default swaps, et cetera. I got a point on each of those.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things when they tell you that the banks were you know giving out these mortgages to people who didn't qualify, one of the reasons the motivation the bank had for this, they were making so much money selling the mortgage-backed securities.
Right, because there was so much demand for them from the New York banks because they could tranche them and turn them into CDOs and make even more money. So they paid big commissions to the banksters.
They got ahead of themselves. And at one point, once I heard this, I heard it years ago, and I completely understood. They got ahead of themselves, and they were actually selling mortgage-backed securities that had no mortgages in them yet.
Right.
So they were selling empty boxes, and they were on the verge of getting caught. There's a lot of tax reasons. There's illegal. It was fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, they had to stuff those empty boxes with whatever they could. And this is one of the reasons that the liar loans just exploded toward the end, where anybody who was breathing could get a loan,
right.
Is that they were on the verge. And now on the credit default swaps, currently, you understand what's going on now with Europe, is that those credit default swaps, those bets that you correctly identified, bets on bets on bets, are on the verge of becoming doable, the ones that are betting against Greece and Europe being able to pay their bills and actually default, credit default swap.
Right.
And right now, they are trying to get people to agree to accept the loss and not call it an actual default.
Right.
It's kind of like if you had rolled a 7 on the crap table
and the stick man going, moving over and going, well, you don't mind if I move that one dice and make it a six, do you?
Yeah.
And you're sitting behind a winning bet.
Right. And in fact, so the Greeks are talking about, they call this a haircut, you know. They're talking about a 50% haircut, a 70% haircut, a 30% haircut. And there's this big fight about it. And the Germans, of course, are very, very concerned because their banks are probably going to take the biggest hit.
Correct. And if they're, the fact of the matter is, they're asking them to do it voluntarily. Please accept this haircut.
Right.
Because if they say no, then it actually is a default.
Right.
And then the credit, and then our banks, and then you end up with a house of cards.
And then, yeah, then you've pushed the first domino, and boom, they go.
And like you said, all these billions upon billions, I mean, you're up to over $900 trillion now in the derivatives markets. Now, not all of those are on the European stuff, but there is a great many that are.
Yeah.
And this thing, then it just cascades,
yeah.
And you end up like dominoes, and
yep.
It just takes down the whole system.
Yep, you're absolutely right. Thank you very much, Dave, for your insights, for your thoughts, and for the validation of my perspective. I appreciate it. Joe in Toledo, Ohio, listening to WDTW. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I've taken your advice. I've listened, and I've gotten active. I'm actually running for U.S. Senate on the Green Party line in Ohio, and we've got primaries coming up on Tuesday, and I'm asking people who want to basically push the Democrats, give the Democrats some spine, because they need a party like the Greens nipping at their heels, a party that won't compromise on things like war and the public option and so many things. I supported Obama, but I could not go back to him once he started pushing nuclear power. So I'm green. I've been green before. Now I'm back with the Greens permanently. And I just wanted to let people in Ohio know if they want a choice, they can go ask for a Green Party ballot and write in Joseph DeMar for U.S. Senate on Tuesday.
Great. Joe, thanks a lot. Joseph, thank you very much for the call, and good on you for getting involved. Paul in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? You provide a great service. You and Free Speech TV provide a great service for this country. But a couple days ago, I heard you say that you think that if Mitt Romney becomes president, that they will rebuild the infrastructure. And I was just wondering where you got that absurd notion from.
Well, I watched it happen before. First of all, the first Republican to do it was Dwight Eisenhower. And he built the interstate highway system, and he grew us out of the Great Depression. Or helped grow us.
Romney's no Eisenhower.
No, but I think that Romney, I mean, you know, the other day Romney said, you know, if you cut government spending, you're going to slow down the economy. He just came right out and blurted it out. And then he realized what he'd said, and he said, but we've got to instead, you know, we've got to cut, you know, and he just blithered into something, you know. I was very reluctant to say that on the radio. And I'm not going to go there again very often.
It's kind of an endorsement for Romney.
I know. The fact of the matter is that if you looked at the Nixon administration, if you looked at the Eisenhower administration, if you looked at the Reagan administration, they followed what the Republicans do when they actually have power and control. You know, Reagan spent most of his administration raising taxes. You know, he had this first giant tax cut in 1982, and it was a disaster. Unemployment went up to 12%. Everybody freaked out. And you know who was the guy who introduced the legislation in the United States Senate to raise the tax rate from 28% up to 35%? Bob Dole. No. I mean, the Republicans. You know, it was the Republicans who were saying, hey, wait a minute, we've gone too far. We're blowing this thing up. And then it was Reagan who spent $1 trillion on Star Wars and other things, but he spent it, and that stimulation of the economy, you know, helped pull the economy out of one of the worst recessions we'd had since the Great Depression that was caused by Reagan's crazy tax policies. So that's why I said I thought that I think that if Romney were to win and he got a Republican House and a Republican Senate and the Tea Party was to get marginalized, and those are a whole lot of ands and ifs, and particularly the Tea Party getting marginalized part, you know, but if it all happened and it all lined up, my guess is that he would put the economy back together and then try and take credit for it for the Republicans for the next generation. I don't think it's going to happen. And in fact, I think, you know, if he was to win and the Tea Party still held the House of Representatives, that what you would see is 4 years of warfare within the Republican Party and the United States would really disintegrate. But I was speaking purely hypothetically, Paul. I am absolutely not endorsing Mitt Romney. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for pointing that out for anybody who may have misunderstood. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be checking in with Victoria Jones in just a few minutes with the Talk Radio News Service to find out what's going on in the rest of the world. Stick around. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, live at the White House. Hey, Victoria, how you doing today?
I'm good, thanks. How are you, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. So what's going on in the White House?
Well, we had the White House briefing delayed. It became clear eventually partly why that might have been. Within the last hour, President Obama called third-year Georgetown Law student Sandra Fluke. Sandra Fluke, you may remember, is the Georgetown Law student who was forbidden from testifying before Darrell Issa's Government Oversight and Reform Committee last week.
Right. They were holding hearings on contraceptives, and he did not want any women to testify. It was all men.
It ended up with an all-male witness panel testifying on what
because
said was religious liberty and the First Amendment.
Right, because everybody knows that men are the only experts on women's reproductive health or religious liberty.
That's right.
Women know nothing about these things.
That's right. You and I talked about this. So she didn't testify. So Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, then had an alternate hearing at which Sandra Fluke was the only witness. And she testified, and she talked about the cost of contraceptives at Georgetown University, which is a Jesuit university which does not cover contraception, and how many women at the university took contraceptives for matters other than birth control.
Right.
And she talked about this issue quite eloquently.
I think it's 14% of all women take birth control pills, not to regulate fertility, but to regulate things like, you know, serious periods or fibroids or whatever.
All kinds of things.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah.
Very severe acne.
It can help with that.
Huh.
Okay, so subsequent to that, Rush Limbaugh goes on a tear this week, calls her a slut, a prostitute, suggests that she's having so much sex. Unbelievable things. She should post videos online. Quite extraordinary things. And so the president called to offer his support, expressed disappointment at the inappropriate personal attacks. Jay Carney called them reprehensible. He also wanted to speak out, that she would speak out on public policy. He said that our discourse has been debased is bad enough, but that it was been directed at a private person is worse. He expressed his support for her, his appreciation at her willingness to stand tall.
Wow, that's pretty impressive to get a call from the President of the United States.
Yeah,
because you were willing to stand up for your convictions. I salute Sandra Fluke. That's great news.
Yeah, she also, by the way, has received support from the president of Georgetown University, who has not only called for more civil discourse, but has apparently referred to the attacks as misogynist.
I think they are misogynist.
I think many people feel that they're, at the very least, misogynist and quite extraordinary.
Yes. So what else is up?
President Obama gave a very interesting interview to The Atlantic magazine in which he says that military option on Iran is not a bluff. I think that the Israeli government recognizes that as president of the United States, I don't bluff. I also don't, as a matter of sound policy, going around advertising exactly what our intentions are. Jay Carney was asked about this at the briefing today, emphasized that this was an interview. This was not a signaling of our policy to the Israeli government, went on to emphasize that we are in close contact with Secretary Clinton, Secretary Panetta, with the Israelis at all times. They are very well aware of what our policy is, and that our policy is that everything is on the table, including the military component. Of course, the president will be meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel on Monday, the president speaking to AIPAC on Sunday, Netanyahu speaking to AIPAC on Monday, also all the presidential candidates speaking to AIPAC as well, so you can expect it to be a resounding table thumping.
Yes, no doubt about it.
On Iran policy.
Yeah.
Also, very interesting developments in phone hacking on the other side of the pond at the Leveson Inquiry, which is a formal inquiry into phone hacking.
In the UK.
In the UK. Peter Clark, the Metropolitan Police's former Deputy Assistant Commissioner, made a very unexpected disclosure this week, saying that the Tony Blair government was secretly briefed about the phone hacking scandal in 2006. And he was head of the aborted 2006 police investigation. They got a confidential report on the phone hacking discoveries. It was sent to the then Home Secretary, who personally discussed it with him. Briefing was also sent to the Cabinet Office at Number 10 and to MI5. So Lord Justice Leveson immediately demanded that he get this report. Now, this raises the possibility for the first time that the Blair government might be involved in a cover-up, because at the time, the Blair government was very keen to keep a good relationship with the Murdoch newspapers, and...
Right. They got him elected, actually.
And nothing ever came out about the Blair government knowing about this, and at least three cabinet ministers in the then Blair government were among the News of the World's hacking targets with national security implications. But this was withheld from the public during the trial of former News of the World royal editor Clive Goodman and Glenn Mulcair, the private investigator who formerly worked for the paper.
Is this why James Murdoch stepped down?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. And is this going to lead to a disintegration of the Rupert Murdoch empire? And might it affect even things like Fox News in the United States and Wall Street Journal? Or is this just a local issue in the UK that's going to work its way
through? I find it hard to believe that it will lead to a disintegration of the Murdoch empire. But I think it might lead possibly to Murdoch's retirement at some point.
Yeah. Interesting.
I do think that. I mean,
and now Rebecca is gone. And his son is gone. Who's his protege?
Well, he has another son
who has been less than active, outspoken, and right wing, if I recall
exactly.
Correctly.
Who's got an unusual name that I'm forgetting, but yeah. Who is now in the fold?
Huh. Very interesting.
So, yeah.
The dynasty, the lifestyles of the rich and famous.
Yeah, exactly.
It's amazing. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by Ellen Ratner's new book, Self-Empowerment. Victoria, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. We will be back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Bad news. Syria bars Red Cross convoy from fallen rebel bastion. Aid workers were preparing to enter. This is from the New York Times today. Aid workers are preparing to enter the neighborhood of Baba Ammar, the epicenter of the four-week government effort to dislodge rebels. This is where, in all probability, yesterday the Syrians went in and just, well, we'll see. But my guess is that there were a lot of executions. This is such a mess. Such a mess. Wayne in Jacksonville, Illinois. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind today?
Yes, earlier in the week, you spoke to a man on the air from the Electricians Union in Chicago, mm-hmm. occupying a shop and maybe managed to gain 90 days to find a buyer so they could keep their jobs. Does that ring a bell?
It does, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know that it was electricians, but it was one of the unions, yeah.
Yeah. I went online to check it out and saw that they were considering buying it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I thought for a little while that the union should be looking at as much as they possibly can as forming co-ops and putting themselves to work. And I wondered what your thoughts were on
that. I don't disagree. And thank you for raising that topic. In fact, a week or so ago, somebody called and said, you know, there's only 300 worker-owned cooperatives of any substance in the United States. And I said, oh, no, there's thousands. Turns out I was wrong. There really are only 300, at least that we know of. There's thousands of smaller ones apparently, and certainly consumer-owned cooperatives like health food cooperatives. But the ones that are out there, many of them are doing very, very well. And I mentioned Peninsula Manufacturing in Madison, Ohio, in Madison, Wisconsin, rather, is just one of the really cool ones. A Union Cab Company in Madison also. Why the unions haven't done this, I'm guessing, is that it would take so much more money to buy a company. I mean, you know, if you've got every worker who's kicking in, you know, a couple hundred bucks a year in union dues, and you've just got a few hundred workers, but you've got a company that might be worth millions, they just don't have the resources to buy it, would be my guess. Yeah. But
well, it seems like something where if they could get a toehold that they could invest their returns and
yeah.
maybe get it to spread. But of course, I'm not a businessman, and it's just a kind of a philosophical feeling that I have. But it seems like a great idea to me.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. My guess is that the magnitude of scale of the cash that would be necessary is probably the biggest barrier. But there are 20-some-odd states in the United States where you can form a B corporation, a benefit corporation, a corporation that works for the benefit of society or a corporation that is a co-op. And we need to change the what are called charter laws, the corporate charter laws, in the rest of the other 20-some-odd states so that this can be done. And there is a trade association for worker-owned cooperatives that is working on this. I'm sorry, I don't have it right at the tip of my tongue. But this is, I think, and this is why I made it the last chapter of my last two books, Threshold and Rebooting the American Dream, the whole idea that cooperatives are an alternative to capitalism, and not only a viable one, but an incredibly healthy one. It's good for democracy. It's good for the economy. It's good for the workers. It's good for the businesses. Nobody loses except Wall Street, and that's fine with me. And we need to be moving in that direction. Wayne, thanks for the call, and thanks for bringing it up. Michelle in Los Angeles listening on K-Talk. Hey, Michelle, what's up?
Hi. The smoking gun for the banksters,
mm-hmm.
It turns out it's the same thing for the homeowners who are trying to, fight off an illegal foreclosure. Produce the note. Okay?
Right.
The banks, when Wall Street sold these securities of these mortgages and sold them to investors, in every single one of those sales, they said, we are transferring the note to you people, to the investors.
Right.
But they hadn't gotten the note from the mortgage broker that sold it to them. So sell a security based on a fraud that they were party to.
Right. And that's why they did the robo signing was to basically create those notes. And this is one of my concerns about this deal that was just made where the banksters are going to cough up $26 billion.
Exactly.
And we're going to give them blanket amnesty. But you're absolutely right. We've had a couple of attorneys on this program as guests who represent homeowners. And what they do is they go in and say, show me the note. And one of the problems that a lot of homeowners have is when they go in and with the bank or in negotiation and try to say, show me the note, the bank just laughs at them. And this is why it's a good idea if you're in one of these situations to find yourself a good lawyer who does this. This is a brand new area of legal practice that's actually growing in the United States, and I'd like to see it grow a whole lot more. Michelle, thank you very much
for the
call.
There's a second thing.
Okay.
Okay, the statute of limitations, everyone thinks that the statute of limitations for prosecuting them is over after 5 years. There are a whole bunch of statutes in the law. I went to a website, federalcrimeslawyers.com, and he lists several different situations. If you falsify a bank record, 10-year statute of limitation. If you falsify a statement, to the FDIC, 10-year statute of limitation. Conspiracy to defraud the U.S., 5-year statute of limitation from the last date of the defrauding.
Wow.
So there's still, the statute of limitations is still, it has not told yet.
That's the criminal statute of limitations. Do you know if there's one on civil lawsuits?
I don't know about civil. I mean, I got this from he lists the actual statutes.
Right.
The numbers that give the 10-year statute of limitations for several different types of offenses.
Yeah, because I know that there are some people who are out there making civil lawsuits against banksters. And we need to get one of these guys back on the program who's doing this for a living to talk about it. Michelle, I need to move along, but thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening on K-Talk. Charles in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. My question is, why do we on the left have, which exposes the lies of the right early on, like, for example, the NAFTA highway, George Bush, and others sneered at that, saying there's no way that there's a super highway network that's going to go to Mexico. And then now that it's happening, it's like, the lie has been established. It seems like when the right comes up with ideas, it just gets believed by the average Joe citizen, and then we have to fight to prove the truth instead of just exposing these things way long time ago.
Well, the reality is, Charles, and thank you for the call, that they have a much better communications infrastructure. You've got all these right-wing websites. You've got every town in America served by a right-wing radio station. You've got right-wing television networks like Sinclair Broadcasting. You've got right-wing national network, Fox News. You've got right-wing think tanks, Cato Institute, Heritage Foundation, the Reason Foundation. You've got the Ayn Rand Institute. I mean, there's a never-ending supply of it, and the reason why is because when right-wingers invest, when right-wing multimillionaires and billionaires invest in these things, they see a return in lower taxes, and that's what they're working for. Cliff in Santa Clarita. We got a minute to the break. Cliff, what's up?
Good day, Brother Tom. I hope your new time slot brings you more viewers and listeners and advertisers.
Thank you.
Expanding the Tom Hartman program is good for America.
Thank you.
Hey, since I don't have the time to go through, I'm going to get right to the stimulus. I live in North L.A. County, and I have a long commute, so I hit like four freeways every day.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, I see the big signs every day, Tom, several different spots declaring that this work project's brought to you by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
Right.
The stimulus is still working.
Yeah.
March 2012.
Oh, yeah.
And, multiply that by several times. My commute, I see several of them, but there's dozens of freeways out here.
Yeah. Okay? And those states they said, like Mitch Daniels in Indiana and John Kasich in Ohio and Rick Scott down in Florida and Rick Snyder in Michigan, those states where they said to Barack Obama and to the federal government, no thanks, we're not going to take your money. We don't want to build light rail. We don't want to improve our highways. We don't believe in that. That's against our theology. Those states are actually showing higher unemployment and lower GDP growth. You're right, Cliff. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Very, very well said. Back with more of your calls here on Anything Goes Friday in the Tom Hartman Program. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Lisa in Los Angeles, in Westminster, California, listening on K-Talk in L.A. Hey, Lisa, what's up?
Hey, Tom. While it's fun to watch the Republican clown show for the presidential primary, there are also primaries coming up for Congress, and we need to give the president a good Congress to work with.
Yep.
So we need to get involved in the primary, not wait till the general election.
I
know people complain in November, they're just a bunch of blue dog Democrats. I'm going to vote the third party. Well, we need to get involved in the primary and get more Dennis Kucinich's on the ballot and more other good people.
Yep.
And then we can give the president a better Congress than he had in the first 2 years when, there were so-called Democrats in the House, but they were mostly like a lot of blue dog Democrats. We need to get good people in. And then in November, I guess go with the lesser evil. This third party thing, it just doesn't work most places.
No.
There's some exceptions.
No, it doesn't. And we had somebody call in earlier saying, he's running on the Green Party for United States Senate in Ohio, which would mean he's challenging Sherrod Brown. And I kind of winced at that because I love the Green Party at the local level. The Green Party is responsible for over 300 communities in the United States having now instant runoff voting. The Green Party is doing some really great work at that level. But at the federal level, if you're going to go in and challenge Sherrod Brown's one of the most progressive senators in the United States. I mean, it's like just personally, I'm a little uncomfortable with that. Lisa, I'm with you. I think that, people need to get involved I'm not one of these, black or white people. I see this whole spectrum, and people need to get involved in these primaries. And more importantly, show up and say, yes, I'll be a precinct committee person so that they get to make the choice of who's going to run in the primaries and what the platform of the party is going to be. They are the most powerful people in the country. Thanks a lot for the call, Lisa. I got to move along here. Kurt in Seattle. Hey, Kurt, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Great. What's on your mind?
Yes, I wanted to talk about Fukushima today. I managed to get my own guy.
Kurt, if you're on a speakerphone, can you pick it up?
Yeah, is that better?
That's a whole lot better.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I want to talk about Fukushima. I know the food supply and the water supply has been increasingly contaminated since those explosions almost a year ago, and it's
especially on the West Coast.
Especially on the West Coast. So when I got my Geiger counter, I was surprised that the numbers were still fairly low. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that was surprisingly high was the steam off my double espresso. It was about 5 times background radiation.
Really?
And so I did a whole bunch of other tests, and I realized that I tested other coffee. I have a TDS thing which tells you how many solids are dissolved in the coffee, and it was alarmingly high, like way off the charts high.
The radiation.
So, I had to give up coffee.
Huh.
Boy, that's tragic.
Yeah, especially in Seattle. Kurt, thank you for the call. I got one of those Geiger counters too, and Louise won't let me walk into a restaurant with one, which is what I really want to do. I'm going to have to just go to a restaurant all by myself. But I have, or a Safeway or something. But I have waved them around a number of places, and when it's rained and whatnot. And the radiation levels here in D.C. are quite low, so that, you know, so far, so good. Mac in Casillo, Alaska. Hey, Mac, what's on your mind today?
And that's Casillo off Alaska. Yeah, Tom, this legislation against the post office trying to break them.
Yeah.
Do you think that's an attempt to break our last venue or avenue that we have to readdress in truth the government when they pull all the fraud that they're pulling, because we can send certified registered mail? What avenue will we have if they lose the post office at that point?
Well, that's a good question. I doubt that that's what was in their mind. I think
you have more faith in the justice than I do.
Well, yeah, perhaps. I think that when the right-wingers, when the Republican Party decided to poison pill the post office, that they had two primary agendas. And I think there's actually a fair amount of evidence of these two primary agendas. One of those primary agendas was to break the union, the largest unionized employer in the United States, to break that union. And the second one was to hand off a bunch of business to FedEx and UPS and any other, and there's a bunch of other companies too as well, DHL, which is owned by a German company, and others, and to get campaign contributions from those people. Post office doesn't pay campaign contributions. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't give money. It doesn't give money to members of Congress.
Well, you know, have you ever read in the United States Codes, Chapter 1 on flags?
No.
Okay. Do you know what a Title IV flag is by chance, Mr. Trump?
Are you citing the sovereign citizen movement and all this stuff about the fringe around the flag, and then therefore we're
well,
not?
Well, that's the flags are the first thing in law that you address, because you're under the prosecution of the flag that's being displayed. The Admiralty flag is an Admiralty flag.
Yeah.
The constitutional flag, Mr. Tom, please, is what's known as a Title IV. For every 1 foot it is in hoist height, it's 1 foot 9 in length. That's the only flag with constitutional rights. All the rest of them tell you that they're desecrated or infringements.
Yeah.
Now, that's the only flag that has constitutional rights, and it's only given to you as a vet on your grave. The flag they give a vet on his grave is a constitutional flag with constitutional rights, or you've given your freedom.
Mac, pardon my being blunt, but I had a sovereign citizen on my TV show day before yesterday, and had this conversation with him. And this is paranoid wackadoodle stuff. I mean, this is the
No, it isn't. Because when you understand the law as it really is, when you're in an admiralty court, you know, you're...
You ever been in an admiralty court?
Yes, sir, I have.
Where is an admiralty court?
Any court you go into is an admiralty court. They're
Title III
courts.
Because you don't think that the courts in the United States are legitimate?
Well, they're known as the fiction state, Tom.
Yeah.
You know, to start with, there will be no truth told in the court today, only law.
Okay.
There's no justice. Now, a Title IV flag means, you know, if people are out there fighting over this flag, that isn't on any government building in this country.
I get it, Mac. Mac, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Coming up next, the good, the bad, and the very, very ugly, and more of your calls and thoughts here on the Tom Hartman Program. Anything Goes Friday, 27 minutes past the hour. Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here with big news. We're moving. Starting March 12th, the Tom Hartman Program will be live 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's noon to 3 Pacific Time. That's the good, the bad, and the very, very sardanapalianously ugly. Sardanapalianously. Yeah, I got it right. Ugly. Okay, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com. Food for your brain. The good. U.S. District Judge Susan Bolton. You may remember Bolton as the judge who last year blocked several portions of Arizona's highly controversial and largely unconstitutional immigration bill. Well, on Wednesday, Bolton blocked yet another portion of the law, which would prohibit people from blocking traffic who are offering day labor services. Bolton ruled that provision of the immigration law was in no way related to the purposes of the law itself and therefore had no standing. In response to the ruling, Governor Jan Brewer said she was disappointed with Bolton's erroneous decision. Kudos to Judge Bolton for continuing to stand up to Brewer and her all-out assault on immigrants. The bad. Sarah Palin. In an interview with Fox News, Palin decided to chime in about President Obama's Quran-burning apology. Speaking to Fox's Greta Van Susteren, Palin called the people of Afghanistan savages who want to turn around and kill our soldiers. While a ridiculous comment coming from Sarah Palin isn't unexpected, you would think she would realize now isn't the best time to further antagonize the Afghan people. Instead, she used an incredibly offensive blanket statement to attack all the people of Afghanistan. President Obama is trying to make peace with that nation, while Palin apparently wants to provoke further unrest and violence, putting our own troops at risk. And the very, very ugly Wisconsin State Senator Glenn Grothman. Grothman, a Republican, has authored a bill that would force Wisconsin to officially say that non-marital parenthood, or single parenting, contributes to child abuse and higher levels of neglect. The bill would also require the state to distribute literature stating this. Grothman's rationale for the bill is the left and the social welfare establishment want children born out of wedlock because they are far more likely to be dependent on government. End of quote. Grothman has previously authored a bill to cut funding to kindergarten classes for four-year-olds. Grothman's assaults on children and a person's right to be a parent regardless of the circumstances are unwarranted and very, very ugly. Wow, that's ugly. That's incredible. John in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, John, what's up?
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure to talk to you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
I called about the recent deal that was made to extend the Social Security tax cuts, which I disagree with, because I think it undermines the system. But what it also does not seem to be getting much attention is the fact that they've cut Social Security extensions to 73 weeks.
You mean unemployment extensions?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Which is half a year.
Yeah.
And it's a significant cut. And to people who have a hard time finding a job, myself included, it's amazing that there's not more attention being paid to it.
We reported on this program at the time that it happened. I talked about it for a couple of days. I am astounded that the Democrats haven't made it very clear to everybody in America who's unemployed and hopefully who votes that the Republicans took the 99 weeks of unemployment benefits that the Democrats wanted to give them, which I think should be frankly unlimited, but nonetheless, they took that 99 weeks and demanded it be only 73 weeks. And otherwise they wouldn't let it get through the Senate or the House. And this is just like so wrong. It's just so wrong. Thank you very much, John, for bringing up the issue. Jeff in Casa Grande, Arizona. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm really curious. There are a lot of those sovereign citizen aficionados here in Arizona. Really kind of spooky.
Yeah.
It's got every police officer who drives a patrol car. They're scared.
Yes, because the reason why they're scared is because there, you know, a year or so ago, there was a sovereign citizen who was pulled over by a police officer and started you know, saying that he didn't have to submit to the authority of the state because it was because the flags weren't the right size and because the letters on his driver's license were in all caps, and he pulled out a gun and killed the guy. He killed the police officer. Yeah.
I saw that. I think it was 60 Minutes or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, what I'm curious about is, okay, you're talking about the size of the flag and all this other stuff. I know a couple of these people, and these are, believe it or not, they're outside their political beliefs and this stuff. They're really rational, nice people, but it yeah. seems that they're basing all of their political beliefs upon these, what they, the basic tenets, or what they call facts. I mean, they're talking about things about court rulings, which I've always thought in the United States, our courts are kind of based on, upon precedent. They're talking about our courts are actually based upon something in the Virgin Islands, according to
yeah, the here's the theory.
Where did it come from?
Well, my personal opinion where it all came from is that there's, you know, some guy who is probably clinically a paranoid schizophrenic who discovered anomalies in U.S. law and has built a huge conspiracy theory out of them. And there are, you know, you're going to find anomalies and variations and weirdnesses in anything as complex as all the laws in all the states and all the, you know, and the history of the United States. But their theory is, in part, and you can read a fair amount. There's a very, actually a very good article about this over at the Southern Poverty Law Center's website. And they don't call them a hate group. And in fact, I had Mark Potok on the TV show last night talking about this after we had one of the head sovereign citizen guys on. And they knew each other. And he says, and Mark says, you know, these guys are not, you know, they're not racists necessarily. Some of them are. But, because they say that here's a piece of the sovereign citizen movement. They refer to, if you ever hear a sovereign citizen refer to a 14th Amendment person, they believe that the Constitution says that God gave us our rights, right? You know, our creator. And Jefferson referred to it as nature's God, but our creator gave us rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So, and at the time, that didn't include African Americans. And the 14th Amendment said that African Americans have the right to vote. Actually, that would be the 15th Amendment gave them the right to vote. The 13th Amendment ended slavery. The 14th Amendment gave them equal access to the courts. And but anyhow, they refer to them as 14th Amendment persons. And what that means is that white people get their rights from God, black people get their rights from the state, and because the state's illegitimate, they're not actually citizens of the United States. And that's one of the larger offshoots of the sovereign citizen movement, is this kind of fundamentally racist group. And then you've got the people who, are into the currency thing, you know, oh, we, you know, our money isn't real. And then you've got the people who are into the flag thing, you know, the flag's the wrong size, and therefore, and look at that congressman, he's wearing a flag that's, it's a flag, and it's got nothing to do with what. And then you've got the people who say that because, and here's the whole thing about the Virgin Islands. Their theory is that when you are born, our government creates a secret corporation, and they use your name in all capital letters. That is the name of that corporation. And they put a couple $100,000 into that corporation, and it grows over time. And that's the money that this shadow government that we think of as our government, but is actually an illegitimate government, that's the money that they use to do all their nefarious deeds. And that when you die, then they cash in this giant insurance policy, and that money goes back to the government, and that's why that's when they finally put the flag on your coffin that's the actual flag, and they acknowledge you only in your death. And the proof that it's the corporation that they recognize and not you as a human being is that all the letters on your driver's license are in capital letters, and all the letters on your Social Security and everything else, it's all capital letters, and most of us actually spell our names with the first letter capitalized and the rest of the word, you know, T for Thomas and H for Hartman. There's only two capital letters in those two names. And so, therefore, that must not be your real name. That must be your corporate name. And some of the sovereign citizens, and one of the ways that you'll know that you're talking to a sovereign citizen or see it, is they will spell United States of America with the U with a lowercase. They'll, you know, not uppercase, not a capital letter. Or they will spell their name with capital letter, they mess with the capitalization. These are the kind of things that crazy people do. And some of you know, and a lot of these people, I think, have just been sucked into these. You know, it's just like the people who get sucked into the Lyndon LaRouche conspiracy, the cult. It's the same as the people who get sucked into the Ayn Rand cult, and they read Atlas Shrugged, and they think that somehow they've figured out all the answers to the world. These are the people who get sucked into the libertarian cult. They think that Ron Paul is going to save us all from something. It's a delusion. And, you know, I don't say it beyond that, Jeff. And I'm not laughing at them. I think it's very sad. And you're right. There's some very good, decent, honest people who believe in all of these various cults that I just listed, including the Sovereign Citizen one. And then there's a few, bad apples in some of these cults who, you know, like the militia movement or the Sovereign Citizen people who are really into the Fourth Amendment persons, not being persons, who are pursuing racist agendas or even, you know, running around with guns and willing to kill people. Make sense, Jeff?
Yeah, the two people I know, they are neither militia nor are they racist. What I'm curious about is what would lead these people in the first place to be willing to listen?
Why does anybody become anything? I mean, you know, why do people join a church? When you look at look at Bill Maher's analysis of religion. Why do people join a political party? Why, you know, we all define our identity in the abstract, you know, by our beliefs. And if somebody comes along and convinces you of something and you don't have a good understanding of civics and American history, then, and it sounds plausible, you might get sucked into it. Thanks, Jeff,
for
the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I guess the bottom line is that all of us, just by virtue of being human, and particularly in America since the 1980s, the assault on civics, are vulnerable to these kind of cults.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And what an extraordinary voice. Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screeners, Paul Edney and Julie Luly, our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum at WYD, to everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program, Dial Global, if you're listening on a commercial radio station, Pacifica Radio, if you're listening on a non-commercial station, Free Speech TV, if you're watching us on Dish Network or DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our program, including Comcast and Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, to Don Rojas and Dennis Trunov and all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you so much. We wouldn't be here without you. It's genuinely appreciated. Jenny in Hartford, Kentucky. Hey, Jenny, what's up?
Oh, well, I was aiming to talk to you about gas prices.
Mm-hmm. Go for it.
But I've got something that's really, I've been fighting with them forever, and it's some companies.
Okay.
About my power chair.
About your what?
My power chair.
Your power chair?
It's a wheelchair.
Oh, yeah. Your wheelchair, okay.
Yes, and I'm on Medicare and Medicaid.
Right.
And I do not want them changing anything in any of those programs. The thing of it is they got me another power chair, and I've had the thing for 2 years. I have not been able to use it.
Hmm.
The old one, I've had it for over 5 years, and I'm still trying to use it, and it's falling apart.
Yeah. So what's your question, Jenny?
Well, how can I get something done with these companies that they say the only thing that they think they've done wrong is they've let me fall through cracks.
Right.
Jenny,
I'm sorry. I don't know the answer to that. Clark Howard is a great guy for these kind of things. You know, he does a consumer show. Clark Howard, you might want to look up his website. But I would suggest that if this is a Medicare issue or a Medicaid issue,
I've talked to them, and they've been checking into it. They told me to try and get them to come and pick it up.
Don't just call Medicare and Medicaid. call your state, call your member of Congress, call your member of the House of Representatives, call their office, their local office there in Kentucky, and say, you know, I've got a problem with Medicare. Will you please step in on my behalf? And usually they will. If you've got a good member of Congress, they will do that. So I would suggest you do that. Jenny, thank you for the call, and thank you for watching Free Speech TV there in Kentucky. Les in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Les, what's up?
Well, for one thing, I'm a longtime fan. I've been listening to you since Air America was actually audible on the Dallas airwaves.
Oh, great. Thank you.
And now I listen online. Mm-hmm. I'm conducting kind of a one-man campaign. People on the air usually refer to privatizing roads, privatizing, in our case, the electric system, and so on. And I would love to hear them refer to that as profitizing. It's more accurate, and it conveys more information.
Oh, that's a great suggestion. That is a great suggestion. Where's a pen?
I want to hear anybody on the air say
profitize.
Profitize.
I love it.
That's what, you know, you profitize. We have, for example, we had state highways that were converted to toll roads.
Right. They want to profitize the roads. They want to profitize Medicare. They want to profitize Social Security. They want to, you're absolutely right, Les. That is brilliant.
Yeah.
That is brilliant. Thank you so much for that. And thanks a lot for the call. Sean in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Sean, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Basically wanted to talk about Keystone, mm-hmm. gas prices, and that whole mess.
Sure.
You know, short statement, it's all about fear-mongering. The higher the prices are, the more you can make up and embellish in terms of, you know, like Rick Santorum saying that you know, it's a job killer to not let Keystone go through. And we all know that it would create very, very temporary jobs. And in the long run, as you evidenced earlier with the jobs lost in the oil industry domestically, you know, it's going to be a lose situation.
Well, let me give you a couple of statistics, if I may, and you can riff on these. Domestic oil output right now is the highest it's been in 8 years. The number of oil drilling rigs in the U.S. has quadrupled over the past 3 years, a 400% increase. I don't know why people aren't talking about this in the news. It's quadrupled over the last 3 years, hitting a new record. Between oil and gas drilling rigs, the United States now has more rigs at work than the rest of the world combined. Big oil raked in over $500 billion in profits over the last 5 years. $500 billion in profits, and laid off more than 10,000 Americans. And the five largest and most profitable companies in the world, BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and Shell, are getting more than $20 billion in taxpayer-funded subsidies, even though they're making all these profits. And why? Because last year they spent $20 million on electing members of Congress.
And, you know, the thing is, Tom, that going along with that, when you were talking to Bernie this morning, he's talking about the situation in Vermont. People a lot of times don't have the option of buying an electric or a solar car because they have limits.
Sure.
At least right now they have limits in terms of their distance that they can go. Same thing here in New Mexico. We all travel great distances, fifth largest state in the union. We don't really have that option yet. Technology.
That's why you need a good high-speed rail system there.
You're right. We only have one. It runs the length from Santa Fe to Albuquerque, and that's it. We have no infrastructure, just as most of the United States doesn't have infrastructure.
Yeah, and it's a shame. And it's something that we could do, and it would put Americans to work, and it would create an economic renewal and revitalization. Sean, thanks for the call. And everybody, and my apologies to the folks we haven't unable to get to today. We are out of time. We'll be back on Monday. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up and participate. Occupy something. We're here occupying the airwaves. Find something you can occupy. Tag, you're it. We'll see you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.